welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 27th of April 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the start of another glorious week here at Radio Albion, and I do have with me today my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing? It's a beautiful day here. What's it like where you are?
Yeah, it's another beautiful day here. We've just had a very sunny weekend, and I've at last been able to get my motorcycle out of mothballs and been out for a spin on it yesterday. Just a short spin, mind you, just to pick up some necessary things from the shops. That was good fun. And I think that we're starting to see now the government's making some sounds as if the lockdown that we've been living under is likely to be lifted in sooner rather than later now, as a result of the public becoming a little bit disgruntled about the fact that we're kind of in a house arrest situation, and we we'd like to have some freedom. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I've also noticed that some of the talking heads and some of the opposition have actually been talking about some of the points that you were raising about a month ago about the economy and what this was doing to the economy. Have you noticed that, Max?
Yeah, I have actually. And I mean, one of the things is that virtually as soon as Rishi Sunak started to announce the packages the government were putting together in order to alleviate the effects of lockdown, I started to sort of clock up the numbers and do a little bit of number crunching. And it became fairly evident there that there was a massive amount of spending that would be indulged in if the government went ahead with all of these things. And virtually straight away, I started making comments on social media that this was the case. But then at the beginning of this month, on the Western Spring website, I published an article where I sort of pointed out where this was going. And if I just sort of quote from it, I've written the Home Secretary, Rishi Sunak, in addition to the 12 billion plus of government spending promised in his first budget and intended to alleviate the effects of the coronavirus, has now promised during daily briefings a further 340 billion plus. This additional money is intended to alleviate the worst of the economic impact that will follow as a consequence of the government's lockdown policy, but at great cost to tax revenues and the consequent increase in the national debt. During a normal year, the government would raise approximately £623 billion in taxes and spend approximately £795 billion maintaining the NHS, other public services and the armed forces, etc. This means that in a normal year, the government will need to borrow an additional £172 billion a year, pounds rather, to cover the shortfall, adding to our national debt, which currently stands at approximately £1,821 billion, so £1.82 trillion. If we assume that tax receipts halve during 2020, which the lockdown is likely to cause, and Rishi Sunak spends £332 billion extra as he has promised, government spending will reach £1,127 billion compared to tax receipts of just £311.5 billion, thereby increasing government borrowing this year by £815.5 billion and taking the national debt to an astronomical £2,636 billion, an increase of almost 45% on previous years. And so that is an absolutely astronomical increase in the national debt. And initially, when Rishi Sunak announced these spending intentions, there was silence from all the usual commentators that would normally sort of pick up on this sort of thing. And the silence lasted probably for the best part of this last month. And now, only within the last week, have people started coming forward and saying, hang on a minute. Now, if we carry on with this lockdown, the economic impact is going to be crippling on the economy. And that's precisely what I've been saying. And so it shows really that people of a nationalistic mindset have got a keener eye for this kind of thing than people that are perhaps more liberal or from the left wing. And so perhaps the public If any members of the public stumble across the Western Spring website or listen to this broadcast, members of the public should perhaps pay a bit more attention to the sort of things that I write and that other nationalist writers write from an economic perspective, as well as from a purely racial perspective.
Yeah, I think nationalists are usually way ahead of the curve. I mean, a lot of the stuff I've been talking about on the coronavirus in the Daily Nationalist is then talked about on the mainstream news a few days later. I did actually think of a silver lining to all of this. The other day I was thinking, oh, we're going to really see some bad inflation and the prices are going to go up. And then I was thinking, well, this is because nobody is working. So there is a lack of products. So the price is going to go up. Also, we've had the oil price, which is completely crashed. And because the oil price has completely crashed, it means that when we are able to get back to work, the actual cost of production is going to be massively lowered to what it was before. And there'll be a load of products that are produced, which will likely reduce the inflation. So there's just a little bit of a silver lining there. With that oil price crashing in the way that it has, it does mean that production is going to be a lot cheaper. So it's not all bad. It's not all bad. But to just take ourselves away from the economy, I've got another news story here, which I think is really quite shocking. And it also brings up the fact that we neglected to mention St. George's Day last week. So happy belated St. George's Day for last week. There are actually two podcasts at Radio Albion that go into great detail as to why Britain has a link with St. George, which I do recommend people listen to. But it seems last week there was a couple who are fans of St. George. They're also fans of the NHS, and they quite innocently decided to combine the two, and they were rewarded by having 50 bags of dog poop thrown in their garden. And somebody spray painted Nazis on the tarmac. And all credit actually to Milton Keynes. It just says the miltonkeynes.co.uk website that actually reported on this, because they did report on it. And a lot of the times this sort of thing just wouldn't be reported because people will think, well, it serves them right for being Nazis. But it is actually quite sympathetic, this report here. A husband and wife have been called Nazis and bombarded with dog poo for marking St. George's Day and supporting the NHS. The disgraceful attack happened in Wavendon Gate after the middle-aged couple attempted to lighten the mood during lockdown. They made a life-size figure of St. George, dressed in the traditional red and white flag and brandishing his dragon-slaying sword in one hand, and displayed it in their front garden. In his other hand, the couple put a sign saying, "The NHS will slay COVID-19. But today, on St. George's Day, they awoke to find 50 bags of dog poo in their garden thrown over the gate, and the words Nazi sprayed in large letters on their path. And I would suggest this is because of the brainwashing that the public have had, that have been told that people that support St. George, people that are patriotic, they are all Nazis. I mean, the person that did this probably thought he was going to get a pat on the back for doing this, and was hoping that maybe Hope Not Hate were going to feature the people that had put up this effigy of St. George and maybe call them nasty names. I mean, you can't have the public brainwashed into thinking that anybody that supports patriotism is a Nazi, and then at the same time not expect them to do things like this. I mean, this must have been absolutely shocking for this middle-aged couple. And as I say, I am surprised that it's actually been reported sympathetically, because you can imagine them reporting that there was a nationalist Nazi protest on St. George's Day. They put up this picture of St. George and they were heckled by left-wing protesters. I mean, that's the sort of way that this would normally be reported. But I mean, it's horrific to think that just for supporting your patriot, the patron saint of England, you get attacked like this.
I think that people that tend to display the St. George's flag on St. George's Day or on other days when they're feeling patriotic, quite often when there is a football competition on, and the assumption is that they are, you know, perhaps of a right-wing or nationalistic political leaning, but that's Certainly not always the case. Very often people are just patriotic. You know, people are patriotic for all sorts of reasons. And I think that it's good to see people displaying the St. George's flag at this time of year, just in the same way that it's good to see people displaying the Union flag. And I think displaying the Union flag isn't an indication of right-wing political leanings at all. It is just an indication of patriotism on the part of that person, and there's nothing wrong with patriotism. I think that partly what this story illustrates is the hollowness of the left wing trope that it's neo-Nazi types and nationalists that go around putting dog poo through people's letterboxes. You know, this is the sort of trope that's always trotted out whenever there's a discussion in left-wing circles about the growth of nationalism in the country. And yet what we find actually is that the perceived growth of nationalism on the part of the people that actually were responsible for throwing this dog poo over the fence, that perceived growth in nationalism was met by a desire on their part to shower the person concerned with dog poo, irrespective, you know, without speaking to the person first of all, without confronting the person first of all, and it just goes to show really that these kind of left wing tropes aren't really so much an illustration of what people on the nationalist right do. It's more a reflection of the sort of mentality that people on the left have.
It's projection, isn't it? They project mm-hmm. their own behaviour onto us. I mean, when you think about it, there's all these celebrations for St. David's Day, there's celebrations for St. Patrick's Day, and St. George's Day, I mean, it doesn't even get mentioned in Parliament. It's a great shame, because St. George was a very important saint for the whole of Europe. As I say, he does have these links with Britain. And I mean, this must have been really horrible for this middle-aged couple. The daughter said, "I'm so mad. We have been attacked for having St. George up on our fence. It's a racist attack." She said her family celebrates St. George every day, and this year wanted to show support for the NHS at the same time. The display was meant to make people smile during the current crisis. Luckily, we have CCTV and we have the perpetrator on it. It's now in the hands of the police. And that's interesting. She says it's a racist attack. And then she says we have CCTV and we have the perpetrator on it. So that means that the perpetrator was of another race, obviously. And this isn't being reported that it's a hate crime. I mean, it's got to be a hate crime. I mean, what else could it be? Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I agree with you entirely. I think it is a hate crime, and I think the daughter is absolutely correct. These people were harmlessly displaying their patriotism and were victimised on the basis of their ethnic origins. Basically, it's fairly plain and simple. And so I hope that if this case does go to court, that the judge involved will add a bit extra onto whatever sentence they apply to the perpetrator, in the same way that it would do if it was the other way round and there was a hate-based attack against somebody who was from an ethnic minority.
It's obviously racially aggravated, isn't it, to be calling them Nazi? The daughter added, "Why do we still live in a world where people can't accept we are all wonderfully different in many ways? Racism of any sort is not okay." She posted pictures of the attack on Facebook, sparking sympathy and outrage from members of the public. "How utterly vile! I hope you get some support from the police," said one. Another agreed the attack was disgusting, but asked a valid question. "I want to know where they got 50 bags of dog poo from," he said. The daughter believes it came from the dog poo bin around the corner, which the perpetrator must have emptied. "My dad cleaned it all up and went to the nearest bin, and it was empty," she said. And again, another point of this that it just makes me think of here, the amount of hate crime hoaxes that we see, the amount of times we hear that there's been a swastika that's been put up, or there's been graffiti that's been put up, and whites are supposed to feel terribly guilty about it. And then a few weeks later, we find that it was actually done by the person themselves that was reporting it. It was actually done by the Jewish owner of the restaurant, or it was done by the black pastor in the church in America. And in this case, there's actual CCTV footage of them. And it comes from the left, and it comes from somebody who was obviously non-white. And I am surprised that this was actually reported on so sympathetically. Because, I mean, this woman is pointing out, look, you know, there can be racism against white people. And that's not something that the mainstream press will ever accept. And, of course, what she's talking here is just... It's complete common sense, isn't it? Why can't people accept that we are all wonderfully different in many ways? Why can't she celebrate St. George? Why does that have to be assumed that that's racist in some way to be proud of St. George? It's shocking. Do you want to comment on this?
Well, I would just say that not only the perpetrator of that attack on this family in Milton Keynes, but also it would appear that Facebook have also been guilty of making the same assumption as well, because I understand that there's been an apology issued on the part of Facebook for the fact that they have cancelled so many people's Facebook accounts just purely because those people posted messages in support, wishing their friends and relatives a happy St. George's Day, and it was deemed by whoever was monitoring Facebook on the 23rd that these were racially sensitive or racially disparaging notices, when in reality they were just statements saying we wish everybody a happy St. George's Day. And apparently lots of these were taken down, and a lot of people have had their accounts, their Facebook accounts, suspended. So that again is just, it just goes to show really that there is this fairly widespread belief on the part of the establishment and on the part of the left that anybody who is in any way patriotic whatsoever is somebody who needs to be persecuted and stopped.
Yeah, I read about that as well. The flag, I think it was Proud to Be English was one of them, and then it had the St. George's flag there, and anybody that put that up was losing their Facebook accounts. And I think that comes down to these anti-hate organizations in America that regularly come out with lists of things which they say are hate symbols, including the OK hand gesture, the Celtic cross, which is a symbol of Christianity, and of course they probably come up with the flag of England. That's now a hate symbol as well. Anything that white people are proud of is seen as a hate symbol by these people on the left, and they're the ones that are advising Facebook, and that will be why Facebook took these down. And it's exactly that sort of mentality that's promoted in the mainstream press, which then inspires people to go and throw dog poop in the garden of somebody who puts up this St. George. It's a vicious circle and a self-fulfilling prophecy. St. George's Day is the feast day of St. George and is celebrated by various Christian churches and by the several countries and cities of which he is the patron saint. These include England and regions of Spain and Portugal, and I think he's a patron saint of Moscow as well. St. George is also the patron saint of the Scout movement, which traditionally holds St. George's Day parades. This year, during lockdown, Scouts are joining together online and renewing their vows. And I don't know whether we covered that when we were talking about Baden-Powell, when we did our little series on Baden-Powell, but I just thought, well, that's good, isn't it? You know, that's just an indication of how patriotic the Scouts are, that they had these St. George's Day parades. I wonder whether they would have been attacked if they were having their St. George's Day parade and called Nazis. Well, there was no mention of St. George by our politicians at all on St. George's Day, but we did get mention of Stephen Lawrence, who, of course, has his own day the day before St. George's Day. And the reason why we had mention of Stephen Lawrence, obviously because he was murdered 27 years ago, but also because Stephen Lawrence's mother will be leading Labour's investigations into the disproportionate impact of coronavirus on black and minority ethnic communities. So Keir Starmer has tasked Baroness Doreen Lawrence, whose son Stephen was killed in a racist attack 27 years ago this week, to drill down into troubling trends emerging in the epidemic. Figures from the Intensive Care National Audit and Research Centre suggests 34.5% of critically ill patients were from the black and minority ethnic community. This is despite 10.8% of the population being black or Asian, according to the 2011 census. NHS England also published statistics that revealed black and minority ethnic persons accounted for 16.2% of deaths, a significant proportion of the more than 80 NHS workers who have died with coronavirus are also from BAME backgrounds. So what on earth does Doreen Lawrence have to do with an investigation into the effects of a virus? This is just unbelievable. I mean, you really couldn't pick somebody who was going to be less objective about something like this. The woman has had her son murdered, murdered by white racists. So they pick her to lead this investigation. I mean, really, if they wanted to pick somebody who was less objective, I don't think they would have been able to find her. Does she have any qualifications in biology, in virology, or anything like that? I don't think she does have any qualifications. I think the only qualifications she has have been honorary ones that have been given to her. And what this basically says is that they already have a foregone conclusion of what this investigation is going to find, and they want her to lead it because of that. It's obviously not going to be scientific, I would suggest, with her leading it. What do you make of this, Max?
Well, I would have thought that there needed to be a scientific dimension to this inquiry, and it would have been good if Labour had announced that somebody who is a virologist or an epidemiologist had been appointed to lead this inquiry as well, perhaps alongside Doreen Lawrence, or perhaps instead of Doreen Lawrence, because then we could have had a greater belief in the, or expectation, I should say, in the objectivity of the outcome. First of all, occurs to me that the difference in impact of the virus could be a genetic thing. It could be that there is something genetic about people from black and ethnic minority groups, or something specially genetic about white people that makes white people less prone to contracting the virus than people from black and ethnic minorities. And that's something that could only be ascertained by somebody who was able to investigate scientifically as to what those genetic differences might be. It could also be that there are cultural differences. It could be that because of their culture, that people from black and ethnic minority groups behave differently with regard to things like social distancing, and that they perhaps, it's been spoken about in the past that people from black and ethnic minority origins tend to have more extended families, and so they're and extended families all living under the same roof, and so it could be that the older members of their families have been disproportionately infected with the virus as a result of that. That's something that perhaps could come out of this inquiry, without there necessarily being a scientific basis to the inquiry. But it's nobody's spoken about that as being perhaps one of the most likely findings that the inquiry might make. It could also be that that black and ethnic minority medics have been more devoted to their patients and could have more selflessly placed themselves in harm's way than the white medics. Then that's a possibility, but that appears to be overlooked. And in the initial statements that have been reported from Doreen Lawrence on the BBC website, she says, let me just find it here. The coronavirus pandemic has brought society together, but it has also exposed the gulf in living standards that still blights our communities. Black, Asian, and minority ethnic communities have long been disadvantaged by the social and economic injustice which still exists in our country. There is a clear and tragic pattern emerging of the pandemic's impact on those communities which must be better understood. She added, I think sometimes the government don't understand, or they pretend that we are not as important, yet we make up so much of the medical profession. And so From those statements, assume that they're correct, of course, if from those statements, it would appear that Doreen Lawrence has cited discrimination as being the main cause of this difference, discrimination on the part of white people, of course. And so that's a shame if that is the situation, because there are so many other reasons that could be found to be the causing factor in the disproportionate amount of black and ethnic minority people falling foul of the virus. But there are other things as well, you see, because as far as the coronavirus is concerned, it disproportionately attacks men as well. So, you know, there isn't only the aspect of there being this sort of racial dimension to the to people falling victim to coronavirus. There is also the sexual dimension, and that, of course, won't be addressed at all by an investigation which is aimed primarily at identifying a reason that is going to serve presumably the interests of the black and ethnic minority communities, or which is going to comfort them. It is also a fact that elderly people are disproportionately affected by the coronavirus as well, and there isn't going to be any kind of investigation into why that is. You know, it could turn out that there is some aspect to youth that could, if it was properly understood, could be transferred to the elderly, which would then protect the elderly from the coronavirus. But nobody's going to investigate that, because that's not a politically hot topic in the same way that race is a politically hot topic. And so it's disappointing, as I say, that there doesn't appear to be anybody who is first and foremost a scientist that's going to be taking part in the in this survey, in this this report, or inquiry, I should say, and it's disappointing that the statements that have been made or reported to have been made by Doreen Lawrence appear to show that she's already kind of targeting what she thinks is going to be found to be the reason, which raises a question over the impartiality of the outcome of this inquiry. And it's disappointing that nobody thinks to protect the interests of men generally by looking at, you know, why the virus is attacking men disproportionately. And nobody seems to have thought that it might be useful to look at why it's attacking the elderly. And so I think that it is a disappointingly narrow-minded kind of inquiry that's been launched by the Labour Party, and all the indications are that it's going to be quite sort of narrow-minded in terms of its the way in which it's going to be conducted.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there, saying that they've already decided that discrimination is going to be the reason for why the blacks are catching this coronavirus, because that really is the only qualification she's got, is it sniffing out excuses for blacks to claim that they're being discriminated against, rather than actually finding out the biological reasons for this or cultural reasons. They've just got somebody in there who's going to be very good at trying to find a way to blame white people, which really is quite insulting to her to actually get her to do this, because that is what they are implying, that's where her skills lie in doing that. And the other point you were making there, Max, that perhaps these black medics are so devoted to their job, they are doing things that the white medics wouldn't do, possibly doing things like not wearing a mask. How brave of them to treat patients while not wearing a mask, or while not properly using hand sanitizer. And of course, as we did here a couple of weeks back, there was a black medic died after not wearing a mask. And he was blaming the NHS for the fact that he wasn't wearing a mask. Another excuse I've heard for why black and minority ethnics are falling prone to this virus is because all the information about it is written in English, and most Muslims don't understand English. So again, white people are being blamed for this. Why they're living in the country and they don't actually speak the language of the country hasn't actually been explained, but I suspect that's going to factor into the conclusions that they draw from this as well.
And why they would be working in the National Health Service dealing with patients when they can't speak the language, that's another big question, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course, we've also got the fact that 80% of the people that are actually struck off from the health service for incompetence are also foreign. Well, Baroness Lawrence's new role began with discussion with Labour colleagues and experts, including the British Medical Association's chairman, Dr. Chand Nagpal, on Friday morning, Muslim Council of Britain General Secretary Haroon Khan, the Sikh Network's Jas Khatkar, and Operation Black Vote founder Lord Woolley also took part. So basically what we have there is one medic to four race hustlers. So I think any talk of there being a biological reason for this is going to get outvoted. I mean, Operation Black Vote, what does that have to do with a virus and an epidemic? Operation Black Vote founder. Sir Keir, who appointed Baroness Lawrence the party's race relations advisor, said it is extremely concerning to see the disproportionate toll coronavirus is taking on black and minority ethnic communities. We cannot afford to treat this as an issue to investigate once the crisis is over. We must address it now. The NHS and Public Health England are also undertaking a review into the concerns, and the government's review is being spearheaded by Sir Trevor Phillips, the former chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. And actually, I don't think Sir Trevor Phillips is too bad. He's spoken up a few times recently about the plight of the working class white lads and how they're not actually being helped enough. But it is quite clear that this is just going to be an attack on white people. They've got no interest in actually finding out if there is a biological reason for this, or even if there is a cultural reason for this, that they could advise them that they need to socially distance more or they need to wear masks. They're not interested in that. They just want to find some way of blaming white people for it, probably saying that we haven't provided big enough houses for them. That's the usual one. Or maybe it's to do with not enough youth clubs. That's the excuse for the stabbings, isn't it? Not enough youth clubs. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
No, I think we've said all that can be usefully said about that, to be quite honest.
Well,
it is just disappointing that that the Labour Party have launched this and that it does appear to have been launched with a kind of foregone conclusion.
Yeah, they've really nailed their colours to the mast there, haven't they? They are not the party of the working class anymore. They're not the party of the white working class. And I think the white working class know this now, which is why they voted for Boris Johnson in the last election. And if this is the direction that the Labour Party are heading in, then hopefully they will fail in the next election as well. Well, let's get into our Greatest Britain, part two of our series on Edward I, the Hammer of the Scots, who was crowned king in 1274. And we'll begin with a little bit of a recap. Last week we talked about the rebellions in Wales, and there are a couple of bits here that I wanted to actually add to what we talked about last week. And the first one was when we talked about Llewellyn and how he wanted to marry his daughter off to somebody, and how the king has said, well, you have to ask by permission for that first. And the reason for that is that he may have been wanting to marry his daughter off to an enemy of Edward's. And if his daughter had then married this enemy of Edward's, it would have led to an alliance between Wales and an enemy nation. So it's not really oppressive or something that's out of the ordinary for Edward to do, to say you need to ask permission first. Because, of course, we will see later on that Scotland actually allied with France against England. So then we had a second rebellion and a third rebellion. And then we saw that Llewellyn was beheaded and the monarchy of Wales was taken by Edward. And he then reformed the coinage. I also wanted to mention why he was called Longshanks, which I neglected to do last week. And he was called Longshanks, not because that was his surname, but because he was very tall. He was 6'2". And there's an actual apocryphal report of someone dying of fear in his presence. He was so huge. Then he expelled the Jews after, first off, banning usury. And there's an allegation that all he wanted was to just take the Jews' money and then accrue the debt to himself. That's what's alleged at Wikipedia. But if he wanted to do that, then there was no need for him to ban usury first, 15 years before expelling the Jews. It wasn't about him wanting to accrue the debts to himself. It was because he didn't like what usury was doing to his people. So he ended up with Wales accepting Edward's sovereignty, and he ends up building castles there. And I talked about that a little bit last week, and I wanted to add some corrections to that. Before I get into that, though, Max, have you got any comments on that? Do you want to over that recap, anything that you want to add to it or that you thought about since then?
Nothing of any significance. You know, as far as Longshanks is concerned, that's quite a well-known sort of nickname that's given to people that are particularly tall, and being 6 foot two during that era would have been to be particularly tall. 6 foot two isn't exceptionally tall today. It is still tall today, but it's not exceptionally tall. But people tended to be approximately, I think, sort of 3 to 4 inches shorter during the sort of medieval times than they are today. And so being 6 foot two, he would have stuck out like somebody who's close to 6 foot six or whatever would stand out today. And so it's obvious why he gained that nickname.
Yeah, I think they didn't get a chance to really grow to the fullest of their phenotype back then, possibly because they didn't have as varied a diet as we have now. That's what some of the nutritional scientists say today anyway. Well, once Edward had defeated the Welsh and he was building these castles, I mentioned last week about Caernarfon, which is the castle that's opposite Anglesey, which is where the current Prince of Wales, where he had his investiture. And I talked a little bit about the importance of this Roman emperor that was there, and how Edward was trying to liken himself to this Roman emperor. And the reason for that is because when Rome was in Britain, the Britons were allowed to have their own laws, they were allowed to keep their own kings, but they did pay fealty to the emperor. And what Edward was trying to do, he was trying to say, well, look, I am like this emperor. You didn't have a problem following this emperor, so why are you having a problem following me? And he actually, according to the Flores Historiarum, during the construction of the castle and the planned town, the body of the Roman Emperor Magnus Maximus, or Maxen Wledig in Welsh, was discovered, and Edward I ordered its reburial in a local church. And I talked a little bit about this Magnus Maximus and the fact that he married this Princess Helen, who he saw in a dream, and then he lived there in Wales. And then I said, and their descendant was Constantine the Great. Now, this isn't actually true. And as I was researching this yesterday, I was getting very confused, because I was thinking, well, Constantine the Great did have a mother called Ellen, and she was the daughter of old King Cole. And I was looking through all my history books trying to find out a confirmation of this. And I actually found confirmation, which explains it all, in a book called George of Lydda by Isabel Hillelder. And this explains the two Constantines. Constantine's father, Constantius Chlorus, is recorded as one imbued with the principles of justice and toleration. His mother, Helena, daughter of King Cole of Eastern Britain, who has come down to us in nursery rhyme as Old King Cole, was a Christian well known for her good works. Helena is recorded in the British Chronicles as surpassing all the ladies of the country in beauty, as she did others of the time in her skill in music and the liberal arts. Her father had no other issue to succeed him on the throne. For this reason, he was very careful of her education, that she might be better qualified to govern the kingdom. Constantine made her his partner, and by her he had a son, Constantine. Helena, born at Colchester, the pious wife of Constantius Chlorus and mother of Constantine the Great, who was descended from the blood of the British kings, and that's all from the Chronicle. Colchester has from time immemorial borne the cross with three crowns for its arms. Helena was unquestionably a British princess, states Melanchthon, and Sonzermen writes, it is well known that the great Constantine received his Christian education in Britain. Constantine, writes Polydore Virgil, born in Britain of a British mother, proclaimed emperor in Britain beyond no doubt, made his natal soil a participator in his glory. Thus, Constantine, by his mother's side, was the heir and representative of the royal Christian dynasty in Britain. But this Constantine should not be confused with Constantine the Tyrant, a British prince who preceded Constantine the Great by about 35 years. The name Constantine was fairly common in those days. The confusion arose in this case, however, by both having a son named Constance. Further confusion is caused by the fact that a British princess Helen, daughter of Eudaf, king of Western Britain, who married Clemens Maximus, named one of her three sons Constantine. This Helen was about 100 years later than the Helena, daughter of King Cole of Eastern Britain, who married Constantius Chlorus, and whose son was Constantine the Great. So we've actually got two Helens there, and two sons called Constantine, and we've actually also got two emperors of Rome. We got Max and Maxentius, who was in Carnarvon. He was the emperor of Rome, and he married the Welsh princess and had a son called Constantine, who turned out to be a tyrant. And then in the east of Britain, you've also got Constantius Chlorus, the emperor of Rome, who married Helena, the daughter of old King Cole, and had their son Constantine, who ended up being Constantine the Great. So you got sort of two similar myths there, and I got a little confused with it last week, thinking that the Welsh Helen that actually had the son Constantine. So yeah, that really confused me yesterday, and I was thinking, what's going on here? And so I'm very glad that I've actually got this book which explained all of that. I didn't want people to get the wrong idea of what I was saying last week. So
well done.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. I'm glad I've got all these history books as well. And one of the things that Edward was really interested in was King Arthur. And of course, actually, King Arthur was part of the same line as Constantine the Great, but much later on. And Edward took a keen interest in the stories of King Arthur, which were highly popular in Europe during his reign. In 1278, he visited Glastonbury Abbey to open what was then believed to be the tomb of Arthur and Guinevere, recovering Arthur's crown from Llywelyn after the conquest of North Wales. And I'll just stop there. So basically, after he had beheaded Llywelyn, and King Edward then became the Prince of Wales, it was known at the time that that was Arthur's crown that he was taking. So this is why he then had this interest in Arthur, because he then saw himself as the rightful descendant of Arthur, because he was then wearing his crown. Also, his new castles drew upon the Arthurian myths in their design and location. So he built them in places that had something to do with Arthur as well. He held round table events in 1284 and 1302, involving tournaments and feasting. And chroniclers compared him and the events at his court to Arthur. So this is a man that is well loved by the chroniclers and well loved by the people. There is no way they would be likening him to Arthur if he wasn't. And to be putting on these big festivals and these big tournaments, you know, the peasants must have loved that. And in some cases, Edward appears to have used his interest in the Arthurian myths to serve his own political interests, including legitimizing his rule in Wales and discrediting the Welsh belief that Arthur might return as their political savior. And he did actually create a huge round table as well, which is on the wall at Winchester Castle, and listeners might have seen pictures of it. It looks like a dartboard, but it's actually a huge, great round table. And I do actually wonder if the idea for the dartboard actually came from Edward's round table that he made, because it does look exactly the same when you see it hanging up there. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just to emphasise something that I said last week, which is that it's a well-proven principle of statecraft that if you become the lord or the king or the monarch of two areas that previously were separate nations, and you've your intention is to unify them, that the way to unify them is to weave a mythic origin for both nations, and to a legendary origin of the great ancestors of both nations that shows them in the same tradition. And I think that what Edward was doing here was doing exactly that, which was taking on the mantle of King Arthur and weaving all of the stories of King Arthur into the story of his monarchy in England, basically.
Yeah, he's linking himself with the Roman Empire through Max and Maxentius, and he's also linking himself with Arthur here by and placing himself as being the rightful inheritor of those titles, basically. It's interesting stuff. Well, now we'll get into what happened with Scotland, which is what he's really famous for, is the wars in Scotland. Not long after King Alexander of Scotland died, there was confusion over who should reign after him. David, Earl of Huntingdon, who was the king's brother, claimed it for himself, but the lords of Scotland refused to have him. John Balliol and Robert Bruce also challenged for the crown. The lords of Scotland came to King Edward to ask him to arbitrate in the dispute, and King Edward, who was gentle and true, made inquiry of the chronicles of Scotland and of the lords of Scotland as to which one was of the eldest blood. It was found that Balliol was of the eldest blood, and it was also found that the King of Scotland should do fealty to the King of England. Balliol was then crowned King of Scotland and swore his oath of fealty to the King, but as soon as he knew Edward was in Gascoigne, he forswore his oath of fealty to him. And this is what we saw happening in Wales as well. Once Edward had settled everything, he would go off to Gascoigne, and then they would break their oath. And apparently this King of Alexander, I think he'd had three sons that died, and he had one daughter that was about 6 years old, and they actually arranged for the daughter to marry a son, but then she died in a boat trip. So, and there were about 15 people that were actually challenging for the crown. And it's interesting the terminology that they use, the eldest blood. And I guess what they mean by that is not that who is the oldest person, but who comes from a bloodline that goes back the furthest, or who comes from the most important. I mean, that is the wording that it used, eldest blood. What do you...
I would assume that is the correct interpretation as well.
Yeah, who had the blood that went back the furthest. Well, Balliol then rebelled. Edward came back and marched to Berwick to make war on Balliol, burning the town and destroying many of the Scots for refusing to honour their word to him. Robert Bruce had allied with the rebellious Scots, and the king imprisoned him, but later forgave him his trespass and released him. And it was when they actually went to war in Berwick, that's actually when Edward took the Stone of Scone to Westminster, which is the Stone of Destiny, which is the stone that's underneath Edward's chair that all the kings have been crowned on. And this war was also started with the Scots attacking Carlisle. But as soon as he was let out, that's Robert Bruce, he started setting towns on fire and killing and robbing the folk of England. So King Edward captured the Scots again and imprisoned them in the Tower of London. Balliol then yielded to the king once more and asked for his grace, once again making an oath of fealty to him in front of many people. Edward then freed the Scots for the second time and allowed them to go back to their land. But Balliol disappeared to his own land, and the Scots chose their own king, William Wallace, this time, a ribald and a harlot who did much harm to Englishmen. And I'll just stop there. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max, or shall I talk a little bit about the Stone of Destiny?
If you'd like to talk a bit about the Stone of Destiny, that would be most welcome.
Well, yeah, when Balliol had actually asked for grace, and once again he'd actually made his oath, they did actually let the Scots take back the crown jewels. And they were going to take the Stone of Scone back, but actually the people of London made such a fuss. They rioted. They said, no, you can't let the Scots take this stone back there. And this stone is a very legendary stone. It was the pillow that Jacob rested on from the Old Testament, where he saw the ladder of angels ascending and descending. And this stone was apparently what all the kings of Israel were coronated on. And at the time when Israel and Judah were removed from their land and taken to Babylon and taken to Assyria, the prophet Jeremiah went to Egypt, and he took with him this stone, and he also took with him the king's daughters, King Zedekiah's daughters. He went to Egypt, and then from Egypt he went to Ireland, where Jeremiah is known as Olam Fodla, and the Irish kings were then crowned upon this stone, and then the Irish kings took the stone to Scotland, where the High Kings of Scotland were crowned upon it, and then it was taken by Edward to London, and this stone is still there in... it's been taken back to Scotland now, and it's got quite an interesting history, because the Scots did try to take it back in the 50s, and there was an all-out countrywide search for it, and they did eventually find it, and it was taken back to London, but unfortunately it had cracked by that time. And Wikipedia has a line in the Wikipedia article which says that it's been proved that this stone didn't actually come from Palestine, and this comes from a book that was written in something like 1997, and that's the only mention that it actually makes of it. But there were actually tests done on it that said that it did come from Palestine, and I've got a book here called Jacob's Pillar, Stone of Destiny, which is all about it. And it says one of the most significant facts about the Coronation Stone is that no similar rock formation exists in the British Isles. Professor Totten, the eminent professor of science at Yale University, after making a thorough examination of the stone, made the following statement: "The analysis of the stone shows that there are absolutely no quarries in Scone or Iona wherefrom a block so constituted could possibly have come, nor yet from Tara." Professor Odlum, a geologist and professor of theology at Ontario University, also made microscopic examinations of the Coronation Stone, comparing it to similar stone from Scotland, including Iona and the quarries of Ireland, and found them dissimilar. Professor Odlum became tremendously interested in the stone. He was intrigued with the idea that perhaps its source could be found in Palestine, as suggested by the ancient records of Ireland. Determined to make the search, and after several weeks of unsuccessful exploration, Odlum discovered a stratum of sandstone near the Red Sea at Bethel, geologically the same as the Coronation Stone. Relating the circumstances of the discovery to a friend upon his return to Britain, the professor stated, "I put on my old Macintosh, I stuck my geologist's hammer in my pocket, and I went out for one last look. It was pouring rain, I walked along the same places I had walked over and over again, looking for stone. Suddenly, while I was walking along a certain pathway, with a rocky cliff on either side, the sun shone on the rain-streaked piece of rock, and I noticed a peculiar sort of glitter that I thought I recognised. I climbed up, and I found that wet rock, as far as I could see with the magnifying glass I had, was of the identical texture I had been looking for. I chipped off a piece from the living rock. I took it back to the hotel and examined it as well as I could. I was sure I had got what I wanted. Although a microscopic test of the sample Bethel stone matched perfectly with the same test made of the Coronation Stone, the professor wanted to make chemical tests of both stones to dispel all doubts as to the source of Britain's treasured relic. To save time, Odlum cabled a geologist friend in England and said, 'Will you do all you possibly can to get a piece of the Coronation Stone, no bigger than a pea, in order that we may submit it to a chemical test?' The geologist friend made application to the Dean of Westminster Abbey to be allowed to take a piece no bigger than a pea from the Coronation Stone. The Dean said, 'I daren't let you have permission. The only way you can get permission would be from the Archbishop of Canterbury.' Application was made to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and this was the reply of the Archbishop: 'To take a piece from that stone bigger than a pea would require a special act of Parliament to be passed by the House of Commons, endorsed by the House of Lords, and signed by the King. And if you get that,' said the Archbishop, 'I still won't give you permission.'"
Right.
So they basically did the best that they could. And I don't know how Wikipedia today thinks that they managed to get a piece of it. And according to Wikipedia, it's just the same stone as a quarry nearby in Scone. And yet the records of this stone go all the way back to about the 5th century. And Ireland used to be called Innisfail, and Fail is destiny. Ireland was actually named after this stone of destiny. It was a very important stone and a very important part of our history. And Edward built a special throne around it and had this stone put underneath it. And all the kings since then have been crowned upon it, basically. And it was a symbol of him taking the sovereignty over Scotland, which had been found in the Chronicles that he had the right to do that, basically. And they must have understood that and admitted that, all these lords of Scotland, because they went along with it. They took their oath. There wasn't a problem with that. And they were supposed to be kings of Scotland, but they were supposed to come to Parliament and take part in the United Kingdom, the same problem that they had with Wales. But they kept on rebelling. They kept on breaking their oaths. And then eventually they settled on creating their own king, William Wallace, as I was saying. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, only that it will be interesting to see what happens when the present monarch dies and Prince Charles is crowned king. To see whether we get the stone back from Scotland to place under the throne so that he can be crowned in the traditional way, or whether the Scots Parliament might object to that.
Yeah, I think they might well object to it. I mean, they are very obstinate, and I mean, you can see that it goes right way back 1,000 years to this time. They were having problems with the Scots, and today, you know, I'm not saying the Scottish people, but the people that are running Scotland, you know, they want to split off from England still, don't they? They want to split off from the United Kingdom and have a referendum and be a part of the EU. And it just seems that they always want to do the opposite of what the English want to do. And it goes back to this time. And of course, I think it's in God Save the Queen, there's a bit about unruly Scots and stopping the Scots from being rebellious or something like that. And we can see here that this is really the origins of it, is everything that's happening here. Twice they've made oaths not to rebel, and twice they've broken their oaths, and now they've decided that they're going to crown their own king, William Wallace. And Wallace actually means Wales, so he wasn't Scottish either. He was actually from Wales. And the Scots then allied with France against the English and began to rob and kill in Northumberland. The king came back from Gascoigne and made his way to Scotland, where the poor folk came to him and prayed that he would have mercy and pity upon them, whereupon the king commanded that no man should do harm to any that yielded to the king, and to no man of clerical orders, no church, and no house of religion, but let them do all that they might to their enemies. And on St. Mary Magdalene's Day, they gave battle to the Scots, and William Wallace fled from the battle. So I think, again, this shows us that he was a good man. He was charitable. And it shows you that the Scottish people might not have supported their Scottish lords and ladies in making war for the third time against the King of England. They quite clearly supported the king, because they asked him, you know, they went to him and said, have mercy and pity upon us. We support you.
Yeah. So it's I'm just really sort of thinking again about the situation. Should Prince Charles be crowned king, perhaps there will have to be a separate ceremony that he'll have to go up to Scotland and sit on the stone of scone in order to be crowned the King of Scotland as well. Or whether the Scots will defer from adopting him as their king. That will be an interesting thing, won't it?
Well, they did actually have Scottish kings. I mean, they've had the Stuarts. They were crowned upon it. There have been kings that have originated in Scotland since this time. But yeah, I think they probably will kick up about it. Edward then married the sister of the King of France, and he was married before then, and he had children before then, as we talked about his son Edward. He was very much in love with his wife. Unfortunately, she died. So Edward then married the sister of the King of France, which broke the alliance between the French and the Scots, before returning to England to besiege the castle of Estravellin in Scotland. Edward then told them that they could either fight him and be hanged at the gallows, or yield to him and take their place in Parliament. And the Lords yielded, and Edward forgave them. So once again, he is showing how charitable and merciful he is, because by all rights, he could have just burnt the place down. Edward then inquired in England about all the wrongs that had been committed while he was away by the justices, and by doing this, he was able to refund his treasure through punishing them. So he obviously fined these crooked judges for the crimes that they'd been carrying out against the people, and in doing so, refunded his war chest. And it was just William Wallace now that had not yielded, but he was finally taken, and on St. Bartholomew's Eve, he was hanged, drawn, his head smitten off, his bowels taken out and burned, his body quartered and sent to the chief towns of Scotland, and his head set upon a spear on London Bridge, that the Scots might have it in mind should they ever take it into their heads to make their own lord again. And he held his parliament at Westminster, and the Scottish lords attended, and they made their oath, and they were told that if any of them should misbear the king again, they would be disinherited for evermore. So they've now been given the same threat that Wales was given.
Yeah.
And he's really had enough of this now. Three times they've actually done this. Now we get to an interesting bit that again tells us something totally different to what Wikipedia does. Robert Bruce then returned and called the earls and barons to him, claiming that he was made to assent against his will to Edward, and that they should make him the King of Scotland. And Bruce actually bribed the Bishop of Scone with £1,000 to help him achieve this. Now, Sir John of Comyn spoke up for the king after all the nobles had signalled their support for Bruce, saying, "How can you call yourself a man of truth when you break your oath to the King of England? As for myself, I will never break my oath to any man, let alone the king." And I think that's a very poignant thing to say here, because keeping to your oath is so important. I mean, if you remember when we were talking about Alfred the Great, he made that the center of all his laws was the fact that you had to keep your oath. Everything, you know, the whole of civilization revolves around people keeping to their word, making contracts, and you know, right at the top of society here, you've got lords and you've got kings and you've got princes, and they're making oaths. And then they're breaking them. And to the King of England. That's still a saying now, isn't it? Who do you think you are, the King of England? And I should imagine that this was a saying for a while as well. I would never break my oath to any man, let alone to the King of England. Well, when Bruce knew that all the earls except for St. John were coming to Scone for his coronation, he sent for St. John to speak with him at the Grey Friars Church in Dumfries the Thursday after Candlemas. The lords were all there for Bruce's coronation, and Sir John refused to assent, once again saying he would not break his oath to the King of England. Upon hearing this, Bruce unsheathed his sword and slew Sir John right there on the altar. Sir John's brother, who was there, then tried to stab Bruce with his dagger, but Bruce had secretly worn armour into the church. Bruce killed Sir John's brother Roger, and then finished off Sir John by beheading him, and the blood of this treacherous murder is still there in the church, and no water will wash it away. And this is interesting, because Wikipedia claims that Sir John Comyn was Robert the Bruce's rival. And he's quite clearly not a rival, he's loyal to the king. He's not rivaling for the monarchy of Scotland. He's laid down his life for the king here, by saying he's not going to break his oath to the king. So the traditional history, or what people are taught in Wikipedia, is that this guy was another Scot that really he wanted to be king. But it's the total opposite of that. And it makes very little point of the fact that he was actually murdered in the church, and that this was a plan all along of Robert Bruce, because that's why he was wearing armour into the church. It's not like it was done in the heat of the moment.
And it's a very different story as well to the story that's told in Mel Gibson's Braveheart,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yeah, so you can see that Edward had a lot of reasons to be angry at Scotland now. Bruce was then crowned king by the Scottish nobles, and soon after he drove out the English from Scotland. And when King Edward heard of this mischief, he swore he would avenge Sir John, and he regretted being so lenient with the Scots, saying that all the traitors of Scotland should have been hanged and drawn when he had them in the Tower, rather than being ransomed. So he's regretting being so charitable and being so merciful now. Yeah, I don't know if you want to add to that, Max?
Well, I think it is, as you say, that a very clear demonstration that Edward Longshanks, far from being a warlike and harsh king, was actually a very forgiving person and somebody who tried to achieve his ends of uniting the British Isles in the most civilized way possible, but was constantly frustrated at every sort of step and turn by people who had lesser motives, and that when he was driven to severe acts, it was as a last resort and not as a first resort. So he was an entirely different person to the person that history has tended to paint him as.
Yeah, he was fully justified. I mean, there was the people that actually murdered John Comyn in the church that Braveheart makes out to be the heroes in this, And really, it was Edward. And you can see that he was a nice guy by all these feasts and tournaments that he would have, and his love of King Arthur and chivalry. And he was known as, this great knight. And we'll see in the final part that he was actually prophesied by Merlin as being the last true king that we would actually have in this country. But we'll have to get into that next week. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.